Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour. This is for January 13th, 2022, in the ongoing series Explaining My Scientific Discoveries. And so this is a year-long project. It'll take all year, and every week I will cover bits and pieces. But this week, something real happened, and that's why I'm going to begin with the concentration on the Venus inferior conjunction flu. This is something that was recognized by the Chinese back in the year 1200, and it was eventually verified. They understood also what happened. It typically would affect the swine first, then that would transmutate into the chicken flu, or otherwise called the bird flu, and then to humans. But recently, we just had such an event. Worldwide, everybody was sick, and I'm going to go through the symptoms because you probably had it, and if you didn't, you're one of the very few people on planet Earth that did not have it. So anyway, it starts out, in fact, I wrote a little poem here. Maybe I'll just start with that. Let me pull that up, and in fact, the words are not finalized yet, but this is, gives you an idea of what's going on. Okay, anyway, here's the words that I wrote, a couple verses, and there could be more, you can imagine. So here we go. Got up this morning, was feeling, Got up this morning, was feeling just fine, felt so good, I had my first sip of that really fine wine. The day passed away and the sunset came around when I heard that eerie sound coming from my old bloodhound. He bays like that when something's amiss. I knew this time he was more than just abyss. I looked up in the evening sky, and what did I see? 'Twas Venus, the evening star, looking down on my friends and me. During the night, I started to feel it coming on. And you know what I mean? Getting worse towards the dawn. Then I starts to feel all distorted and green, then my throat starts to ache with sneezes cut to my spleen. You better believe that as hard as I fight, I just kept getting sicker as I passed on into the night. I've been here before and I know you have too. Once again, I got those low-down Venus inferior conjunction flu. Okay, so anyway, I didn't quite read that right, but I think you get the impression. If you did not have this, then you are one of the few people on planet Earth that didn't. That's like I say. So anyway, it starts out, and okay, I'm going to go through the science of this. It was first discovered around the 1200s by the Chinese. This has been written up in the medical journals. It is recognized in Western science, but nobody knows why it's going on. So that's something, one of my discoveries. In fact, it could be, I am placing this, in fact, on one of my Nobel Prize lists for a Nobel Prize in Medicine, understanding the Venus inferior conjunction flu, a phenomenon that's been known about longer than many things, you know, since the 1200s. But basically, here's what goes on. Venus is still a comet, like all the planets, they're acting as comets. And when we have the inferior conjunction, Venus comes between us and the sun, and it's the electrical discharge of the comet is accentuated because of the electrical connection with Earth's electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. So it accentuates. So Venus builds up a tail that is much longer and much, in fact, we have physically seen the comet tail of Venus during certain eruptive times. And probably would have been able to see it if the conditions had been right during the passage of Comet Leonard. But at any rate, back to, and I'll be talking about that too, because Comet Leonard accentuated the electric field and plasma discharge of the planet Venus and caused us to start this much sooner than typical. Typically, it's right around the inferior conjunction time. In other words, it's the actual discharge, which is creating the building up the ion chains and basically the viruses in the tail of Venus. And I should add to this that when the deep impact spacecraft went through the tail of a comet, it picked up material in a foam-like material and brought it back to Earth. And what did they find but the pieces of viruses, literally the nucleotides and building blocks of viruses. And so we know from physical evidence that comet tails produce viral material. And so then I'll be talking also about what do these really look like? Are they really viruses? Are they living things? And I would liken it more to snowflakes. In other words, random, basically trash. And basically a snowflake also is built in an electric field. You need an electric field to build snowflakes. And in the case of the, we'll just call them viruses right now because they're extremely small particles. And what happens is when they get into your body, when we pass through the inferior conjunction tail of Venus, and this stuff comes raining into the atmosphere. I mean, literally everybody on planet Earth gets a dose of this, and especially if it's raining. But this started this year. The inferior conjunction of Venus was just 2 days ago on the 9th of January. But the people started getting sick on the 4th, and that was accentuated by the comet Leonard interaction with planet Venus. And so that means that the big fan tail of Venus was way out there, way a big broad tail. And so we started encountering that on around January 4th. That's my closest reckoning. There may have been people getting sick prior to that. But let me do a little segue here for just a second. Now, let's go way back in history. Now, the Mayans did this. The Mayans had a Passover ceremony. It's in the Popol Vuh. The other civilizations did also, and we know about the Passover that the Israelites did. The Israelites who were living in Egypt at the time under the eventual direction of Moses when they left. But this was all precursor to the, remember, the seven plagues. And they went in their huts, and they blocked all of the windows with mud, and they blocked the doors with mud, and they painted, or they killed a lamb, and they went into their dwellings, and they had the food they needed for the group of people in the dwelling, and they painted the lamb's blood over the door. And that was a symbol that if you came to that door, I don't care how hard you pound on that door, nobody's going to open the door. And so the Passover, these people were prepared. They knew about this. They knew about the poisoning of comets. And now let's, I'll talk about that a little more in a minute, but let's go to 1910, the passage of Halley's Comet, when this is where science, so-called modern astronomy, went askew, because they laughed at people who were afraid of Halley's Comet coming close to Earth, and there was a big scare, and rightfully so, that we were going to pass through the tail of Halley's Comet, and there would be arsenic, and people would die. And this was kind of like deer in the headlights, because people instinctively know that comets cause plagues and problems. And it's the leaders of the world, through the Carl Sagan idiots of the world, who always want to make it sound like, no, there's no problem from outer space, especially comets. They're just little ice balls. They couldn't hurt a flea. And that's when science started mocking the public, incorrectly, because science did not know what comets were. They thought that they really didn't know in 1910. It did not get solidified, but they always had this kind of ice ball comet model fantasy, which went all the way back to Kepler. Kepler was the first guy to recognize that comets were not the Aristotelian fire up in the atmosphere. That's what Aristotle had taught, and that's what had been taught since the ancient Greeks up into the Middle Ages. And Kepler said no, because of his calculations and understanding orbital dynamics. He said, no, those comets are out there. They're in orbit around the sun. So then the concept came in, and that's the same time when Halley had recognized the repetition of the comet that bore his name, Halley's Comet. And so they recognized that there was something going on with the sun. As these got closer to the sun, they were more active, so they thought, oh, that must be like melting ice or sublimating ice. Sublimation is the process of going directly from the solid ice to gas. And that is what stuck to today up to the 1950s with the Fred Whipple ice ball comet model, which transformed into what they call today the dirty snowball comet model, etc. All of it incorrect. But at any rate, I want to go back to the Passover now and really get into detail there, because now during the Passover, this is when the comet Venus was coming. It had already ripped off the oceans and atmospheres of Mars, and the people then knew that if a comet came and we passed through the tail of a comet, that there would be poisonous material in that comet tail. And there is. There is. And now, eventually, the comet became planet Venus, where we see it today, and that's what my work explains also. Another very deserving Nobel Prize theoretical work, which I did, when I originated all this material, and it solidified when I was at Cornell, 1979 to 81, and what I call the Cornell years, very important time and timing. But the comets are drawing in the material in electric fields, and it gives you a chemical, basically mixing bowl of chemicals. And this is where the nucleotides, you have the essentials of life, you have the phosphate, you have the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen materials coming in and forming naturally in these electric fields. And basically, as free atoms and as free molecules, the H might be in an H2 form, the carbon might be in a C2 form, a molecule, or they may be independent atoms, and the oxygens, the O2s, or the O single atomic form of oxygen in outer space, but they're combining in the electric fields, and then if you pass through this, in being Earth, then, I mean, this stuff just comes raining in. But you don't see it. It's in microscopic form. It's in, down to the form of viruses, the nanometer size, very small molecular size particles. But when they get into your lungs, your body goes crazy because it recognizes it's being inundated with this material. So anyway, this is going back to the Passover. So those people knew. The Maya did the same thing. So in previous knowledge, the people, the indigenous peoples of the earth, had experienced previously with comets, and it was known, something that has been totally lost with modern man. And so when they say, oh, modern man, the most advanced civilization that ever inhabited Earth, we don't know collectively, I do, and I try and teach that on this radio show, and I know all of you out there who got sick. I know. I don't have to. I have seen the reports, the emails coming in to me. Professor McCann, you were right. I never get sick. I'm sick. And the symptoms. So let me go through the symptoms, because I know you had them, and if you didn't, you were next to people. Now, I want to also tell you that this is it's not a virus that you can replicate and give to somebody else. This is something that everybody gets. And now, I've lived in the tropics also, and I know that especially the first rains of the season, when you have dry, dusty conditions, and then all of a sudden it rains, the rain brings down all of this material that's up in the atmosphere, and a lot of people get sick. I was on the John Moore show, which I'm a regular guest regularly, and I was talking about this, and a caller called in, an obvious Indian accent. His name was Ahmed, and from India, Indian accent. And he said when they were children, the parents would tell them, do not get wet from the first few rains of the season. And if you do, you're going to come home sick. with the viruses that are in the air that come down with that rain. And so this is what happened during the Passover. These people took all the food they needed, locked themselves, blocked the doors and the windows with mud so that only air could in that room would be there, and they had to stay there for a number of days. And also, from my understanding, they had, I think, pigeons or some bird like that. And they would put them in a little cage. They would open a door for just a second and put them out right outside and then close the door again. And if the bird died, then they knew that they could not go out yet. And that's how poisonous the air was. Remember that the pharaohs, all of the people, the pharaoh's own sons died because of this. And then he started to become a believer. He went back and forth between letting the Israelites go with Moses and not. And the whole story is very clear. But this Passover event is a very important event because it's because the comet Venus was coming by very close. We were clearly going to be within the coma of Venus and the poisoning of the air event that comes from comets. And so now, with the inferior conjunction of Venus, as I said, recognized in the medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals, recognize this as a legitimate phenomena. And I'll also say that the sun has accentuated activity when we have the inferior conjunction of Venus, with Earth and Venus aligning with the sun. The sun has its solar activity enhanced because the electrical discharge is part of the fusion fire, which is up in the atmosphere. Other Nobel Prize winning work of mine, but I'll be talking about those details later. Okay, so anyway, let me go through the symptoms of the Venus inferior conjunction flu, as I call it. And I don't believe anybody has given it that name as such. And I like my little rhyme there. I thought that was fun. I sent it out to some people, and then I decided to put it on the show here. But the symptoms, it usually starts with a sneeze or a cough, and it's because of a tickling up in your nose. Way up in your nose, you get this little tickling, achoo, you know, and you sneeze, or maybe you cough, maybe it affects your lungs, but that's the first wave of maybe, 100,000 of these little particles going and settling in, and your nervous system picks up and reacts to these and tries to get rid of them. It's trying to get rid of them. It recognizes, hey, this is not good stuff. My body's going to try and get rid of this before it ever comes in. But by that point, it's too late because you're sneezing. It ruptures maybe some cell membranes on the surface. Sneezing is very difficult up in your nasal passages, and it gets into your bloodstream, and all of a sudden, you start to feel maybe a little dizzy. It affects people a little bit differently. But the first step is usually a headache or a head phenomenon. And then it works down into your throat. You have a sore throat. You're coughing. And then it works down into your lungs. Your lungs are developing fluid. You're coughing. And then one of the final stages is where you still have your head is producing liquid trying to get rid of this, and that's especially when you sleep, flowing down into your lungs. So for many days afterwards, you have this persistent cough, and you get a headache, you get dizzy, you don't vomit. This is characteristic too, is you typically don't vomit. You might get a stomach ache, and some people might think they're going to vomit, but they actually don't. And vomiting is, if you do, it's very rare, let's just put it that way, with the Venus inferior conjunction flu. Now, I've been following this for decades. I've known about this. I talk about it on my radio shows. I've talked about the explanation of why it happens. Why would Venus inferior conjunction cause flu on Earth? I mean, how absurd. I mean, what's the connection there? And I have discovered what it is. A very natural part of my theoretical work, that planets are discharging the solar capacitor that they electrically align. Earth's electrical discharge connects into Venus. It's accentuated. The Venus tail moves out farther, is enhanced. And so Earth passes through this tail of viral material. And it comes in molecular form, but, I mean, as more than the grains of sand on the oceans. And everybody is affected by this. That's why the whole world was sick. The whole world, everybody. I know people all around the world. Everybody I knew was sick. And they all wrote to me and they said, well, you're right. And what I was surprised, the only thing that surprised me this time was how early it began. I started getting the reports on the 4th of January and I myself got sick. If you remember my voice last week, frog voice, is that really Professor McCanny there? No, that's, yeah, it is. But with a frog voice. And so I had it too. And I was dizzy. Oh, I didn't feel good at all. But what happens is your body builds up, your immune system builds up, and you can get rid of this. Now, there are potentially right now a lot of people who have destroyed their immune system by taking this clot shot. And so it's hard to say what the reactions would be in those people who have destroyed immune systems and cannot fight this off. The inferior conjunction of Venus was January 9th, so 2-3 days ago. The sickness started, the reports that I got anyway, were on around the January 4th, so a full 5 days before the inferior conjunction. And that just tells you how big and wide the Venus tail was, that we were already into it 5 days before the inferior conjunction. And just to give you an idea, we're on the leading edge of the Venus tail, because Venus is coming around behind us. It's moving faster in its orbit. So the tail is sweeping around, and it could have been accentuated too. Sometimes the solar wind is curved. And so it's hard to say, but typically the Venus inferior conjunction flu does not start until very close to the actual date of the inferior conjunction. So typically it would have been starting on the 8th, maybe the 9th, and then and typically it's a couple days afterwards, the 10th, 11th, 12th, in the case of the January 9th being the inferior conjunction. But no, we were January 4th getting reports, people getting sick, and I thought, well, this could be something else. But then, no, when it became so universal and everybody had those symptoms, the Venus inferior conjunction flu symptoms. Now let's talk a little bit more about what it is. Is this one virus that is being made up there and it's replicated billions of times? No. What these are, and I liken it to like snowflakes, and they say that there are no two snowflakes alike. And you could probably make a similar statement relative to the viruses that are being built in outer space. They're being built in an electric field. They have a crystalline lattice formation, in that they're much like a snowflake, but a snowflake is a six-sided symmetry based on water, literally. Whereas the carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphate viruses are much more complicated. Okay, and so but the point is, you have this expression that no two snowflakes are alike. Well, that's a different way of saying there are very millions and millions of variations of a snowflake. But the people who study snowflakes understand that, yes, there are snowflakes that are very similar. But if you come right down to it, down to the atomic level, there probably aren't any two snowflakes that are exactly the same. Because there's billions and billions of atoms there. And because of the, well, anyway, that's a different story. I'm not going to go into that now. But the point is that what you're probably getting is millions of variations of these small molecules. And when they get into your system, understand how your immune system works. Your immune system knows the stuff in your body. And that's part of the thing that happens when you're a little kid. You're crawling around on the floor, there's gunk on the floor, you're putting it in your mouth, Your body is recognizing things that are good and bad, and it gets rid of the bad things. And that's the education of your immune system. So when you get up to the point of, say, having measles, which is a disease that you can create a natural immunity to, the body is learning that, okay, that's something that you don't want in here, and you got to get rid of it. And all the measles, the bumps on the body, and all of that other stuff are the body's reaction to getting rid of this, learning about it, learning how to classify and recognize that measles virus and get rid of it. And so the same thing. And so when you're, when you breathe in this stuff, the actual sickness is your body reacting and getting rid of it. And so, and that's the case. And that's why, in a lot of cases, people who were sick during the COVID issue, their bodies were reacting to something. And so, the typical regiment that they recognized was working was to give them steroids, the chloramine compounds that would then reduce the overreaction and your body's overreaction. People were actually dying from the immune system overreaction called the cytokine storm. They were actually dying from the immune system overreaction to being inundated with something. And I believe that in a lot of cases, the early deaths were caused by graphene oxide being put in ventilation systems, like in nursing homes, etc. And it's very difficult. There's been other videos. I talked about this. There have been other doctors, medical doctors, who've discovered this same thing, coming at this from a completely different approach. But the point is that your body's immune system knows all the stuff in your body that should be there. And when it sees something that is not in that list, so to speak, then it tries to get rid of it, because this is a foreign subject, and there are many mechanisms. And by the way, the very final stage of the Venus inferior conjunction flu is sweating. You might sweat, like for one night or two nights, profusely, and you're just sweating. And that's your body putting this into the little sweat glands, taking all this stuff, putting it there, and then your body flushing it out via sweat. And I sweat really, really one night. I sweat my butt off. Let's just put it that way. And then the next night I sweat also, and everybody I know has that final stage of sweating. And that's the way your body is getting rid of the molecular structures that come in through the venous pollution. And then it's over until the next Venus inferior conjunction. Okay, so very important real-life science going on here. And what does standard science know about this? Nothing. boys and girls and grandmas, do you know how ridiculous this is? I'm paying for my own airtime on this radio show. I'm giving you information that you will not hear anyplace else. And certainly not from standard science. Not if you go to your doctor, he's not going to tell you this. He's not going to tell you that there's a virus chain that comes in from the inferior conjunction of Venus. He's not going to know anything about it. The university, if you went to the university, mycology or virology department of any university, they're not going to know a thing about it. If you go to the astronomy, astrophysics, space science department of any university on the planet, so-called top scientists, they won't know anything about this. Is this bizarre that you have to listen to me paying for my own airtime and broadcasting this to you, the public, for free, basically for free? Yeah. And that's where you go to find real information today? It's just beyond bizarre. Okay. Anyway, I don't want to concentrate on that. Remember, this show is about talking about my scientific discoveries, but I had to get in the inferior conjunction of Venus flu because it's timely. It's a perfect example. And then tie it in with the Mayans, who had a Passover, By the way, there's a group of Indians from North Dakota, or American, I don't like the word Indians, American Native Americans from North Dakota, who practice a Passover also, and they're also white. They're white people. And so they're Caucasian, let me put it that way. And it appears they're remnants of the Israelites who ended up in Northern Europe. So at any rate, there's more than one group that honors the history of the Passover, and it's the same in all places. You barricade yourself into a hut or a house or something. You have to physically seal it so that no air can come in or out. And you have to stay there until, and you have to have all your food prepared because you can't have a fire. If you got this baby closed up, you can't have a fire in there. So they had killed the lamb. They had prepared all the food and everything, so they had food to eat. And like I say, what they would do is they'd put a bird right outside the door or a little window. They'd open up the window, put a bird out in this little cage there. And if the bird died, they'd know, okay, don't go out yet. And then if the bird lived, then they, okay, open up the door. We're free to go out. And all these people did this. The only people that lived through this were the people that knew enough to do the Passover. And so these people knew about this historically. Okay, on to the next topic. Now, I talked, I think the very first topic I should cover here, because last week I left off and I said this week I'm going to talk about how I began including electric and magnetic fields in celestial mechanics. And that I had done before I got to Cornell University. The other thing I want to talk about is my work on galactic formation. And I also approached that topic in episode one last week. This introductory paper was, I had a quandary when I was at Cornell, because I had developed by that time all of this theoretical work, and I had a book that was 300 pages long. And that I wanted to boil down into journal articles with the technical information. But I had a quandary. Should I present all of this theoretical work, which replaced literally all of the major scientific theories of the day, with a single paper? Because if I didn't, then any one of these topics, the plasma discharge comet model, or the galactic formation, or the fact that there was no Big Bang, or the missing mass issues, and the whole laundry list, the induced electric dipole redshift, all of these concepts coming in were new. And if I just put one of these papers out there, they would go, well, this doesn't fit in with anything we do. It doesn't make any sense. Reject the paper. And so trying to publish this piecemeal didn't make any sense, but trying to publish it all at one time would be such an onslaught of challenge to the entire bureaucracy of science at the time that it would be rejected out of hand also. Like, who is this person trying to replace everything we've done in science? So I had a quandary. And so anyway, that's when I went up and I talked to a guy named Hans Bethe, who is a resident professor at Cornell, a Nobel Prize winner, and a very wonderful person. And I talked to him, and I said, I got this problem. And I was talking to him about my solar model, which showed the fusion up in the atmosphere. And he was the one, he won his Nobel Prize for solar fusion physics. But at any rate, he's the one that directed me to start publishing with the European journals where my papers started getting published. But the importance of that first paper, which you can see, it's called Continuing Galactic Formation. It's in the appendices of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. And it might be in the Atlantis to Tesla book. I'm sorry, I don't remember offhand. The Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the appendices, has the three-part comet paper, and it may well also have But if you have my books, you should have all my books. It'll be in the appendice of one of those two books, but it's the Continuing Galactic Formation paper. And it's a, by itself, there's probably about five Nobel Prize-winning discoveries in that paper. And the reason is because standard astrophysics had been stumbling for probably 50 years over this topic called missing mass. From the time they did the very first light curves, they're called light curves, understanding the velocity flow in the galactic arms. They did redshifts and blue shift measurements in the galactic arms, and they don't make any sense. They don't make any sense at all. And so what I did is, through a mathematical analysis of a three-dimensional plasma flow problem, solved that issue. Also, I talk about the, because of that solution, the star systems were falling back down into the center of the galaxy after their tour through the galaxy. And at the rate of about one per day was the estimate. And that would explain the gravity waves that were being observed by a scientist named Weber at the time. And so that was another thing. And since then, Nobel Prizes have been given for understanding of gravitational waves and measurement of gravitational waves and their meaning, what's causing them. And so the other thing, the biggest issue, though, was not only the light curves of the galactic arms, but it resolved the issue of the missing mass. There was no missing mass in galactic arms. They had to insert the missing mass to make up for the idea that the arms were rotating on like a record disc as a solid, and it doesn't make any sense from a gravitational standpoint. So they had to add missing mass out in the galactic region, and it had to be perfectly symmetric. It had to be such that there was more mass in the arms of the galaxy than there was in the nucleus. I mean, it didn't make any sense at all physically, but they were still laboring over this. And I remember talking to people like Ed Salpeter at Cornell, and they were just indignant that there was missing mass there and it was in some other form. And of course, today it's taken on the form of this invisible mass and invisible energy that everybody is talking about, which once again is a result of failure of other theories. They have to invent something that you can't see or detect to make up for the lack of physical reality in the theories. So as with most theoretical work, the names change, but the baloney doesn't. And so at any rate, they now call it dark matter and dark energy. That's supposedly a high percentage of the material in the universe is undetectable. So anyway, this very simple few pages of this galactic formation article solved all of these problems in a single swipe. And it also showed why there were primarily twin star systems in the galaxy. When you look out in our galaxy, you see primarily twin star systems. About 75% of the stars are in twin star systems. There are higher order star systems, but like three star systems, but they are technically twin star systems because you have a distant twin star orbiting a main star, or you have a close pair with something orbiting it. And so in the gravitational sense, in the classification sense, they really are acting like, even though they're triple stars, they are acting like twin star systems because of the close grouping of two of the stars. And so, at any rate, the if you count those as really being twin stars, 99.99% of all the stars we see are in twin star systems. But if you have a so-called traditional collapsing dust cloud that forms star system, there's no limitation because the orbits are already well defined. And that's one of the things the so-called Laplacian system of solar system formation, where all the planets and anything surrounding the central star are already in their organized orbits, then you don't have an issue. So you could have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 stars surrounding the main central star with no problem. But you don't have that. And then what you find is that everything else was captured at a later date. Now, another topic that I want to bring up now is very, very important. When I was at Cornell, I spent a good deal of time, more than a good deal of time, in the libraries, because it was the Library of Congress. And I came across a two-book set by TJJC, S-E-E, and his he was co-authored. But these were massive volumes, and there was a lot of data tables. And what they were trying to show is that a technique for developing solar systems was with what they called the resisting medium. Well, eventually it was discovered that there was no resisting medium. But they had incredible mathematics. They had done an outstanding study. And so this whole entire concept and belief system was put on the shelf as being inconsequential or inaccurate or incorrect. And what I realized was that with the plasma discharge comet model, with the comets bringing in the tail material from vast areas outside of it, out in the region of the solar system, that it reinstated this concept of the action of the resistant medium. And it did two things. It circularized the orbits, and it reduced the orbits. So if the original orbit of a comet was in an elliptical orbit, then through tail drag, and this is what my addition was that this was being done by the tail drag and not the resistance of the so-called resistance medium, but it was the same end result. So you had comets that eventually could become planets in circular orbits, and that's what happened to Venus. Okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself just a little bit here, because I want you to see where this is going. Now, the importance of the twin star systems coming out of galactic arm formation is that all of the stars, substars, but all of the planets and moons, etc., of a solar system were adopted later by capture. So capture was the primary mechanism for formation of solar system, not some kind of magical collapse of a single dust cloud at a single time. Okay, and so now I'm going to go back quite a few years, because this paper and this work and the Galaxy paper was the first peer-reviewed published paper that I had. And if you look at the title on it, you'll see J.M. McCanney, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University. And so what happened is, of course, I had been thrown out of the physics department for trying to publish these papers, and they blocked them. And then I went across campus and I got rehired by the mathematics department, where I spent the next year and a half and eventually began publishing my work again. And so you find my name as Department of Mathematics, Cornell University, much to the surprise of the mathematics department, because nobody in the mathematics department had ever published in a peer-reviewed astrophysics journal ever in the history of Cornell. I was the first person there to publish in a peer-reviewed astrophysics journal. Anyway, it's very important, because now what I'm going to do is jump back to a number of years before I got to Cornell. And that's when I was teaching. I was in a foreign country. I was teaching at a university level. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons they hired me at Cornell, is because I could teach physics in a multi-language setting. That's what they needed. They needed people who are multilingual, had taught physics previously in a multilingual setting. And I was it. And I walked in the door, as I told you before, I had I went to Cornell. I was in Ithaca for and all of this too, as I weave through these during different epochs of my life, somebody was moving me. Somebody was putting me in different places at different times, preparing me for different roles that I would have and different things that I would have to study and understand in the future. And this happened repeatedly. But at any rate, I was in Ithaca, and I was actually doing something else, and I decided to go up to Cornell to see if I could get my PhD. And I applied, and when I went in for my interview, they said, no, we're not going to let you be a student, but you can teach here. So I ended up with a teaching position. Anyway, the whole issue is that I had been preparing years before, and somebody was helping, and I would just say the big guy upstairs. That's my best explanation. Because when you ask, and it's something I've done throughout my life, as ask for guidance, you get it. Because it's impossible, absolutely impossible, for us to know when good things, sometimes bad things happen. You go, why is this happening to me? And later you figure out, well, this was preparing you for something else, that you needed this in your life at a later date, and somebody was pushing you in the right direction. And so anyway, that's the story of my life, is having direction, coming, going to places, not really understanding why, eventually realizing that's why I was there at that particular moment. Okay, so now I'm going to go back to a number of years. Well, during my college years, let's go back to my college junior, senior year, where I started to really look at gravitational systems and started to work on the n-body problem in gravitation, trying to understand three or more bodies analytically, the analytical equations. And so one of the things I always did was visualize the fields. And these are like gravitational fields, etc., electric fields. And it was after that, after I was out of college, I started to, just for fun, working on this project, this my own particular project of the n-body problem, I started combining electric and magnetic fields with gravitational systems, just to understand what they would look like, how would they act, what things have influence. And typically, your first venture into this would be to go, well, electric fields are much stronger. They have a big effect, and where gravity is a very weak force, but it's really not true. And what I discovered through my analysis was that electrical fields and magnetic fields were very weak when you went to gravitational systems. And the reason being is because the surface charge on an object really doesn't, it's not part of the object, it's surface charge. And so if you come by with another charge, it's going to move around the surface of the object, but it's not going to pull on the object. It does not have a physical connection, whereas gravity is part of the object. The gravity caused on one object from another object is working on the object itself. And so right out of the chute, electrical forces are not really that powerful in outer space. And the other thing is that because it's surface charge, as you get to bigger and bigger objects, the surface density, before it will bleed off, never really grows to very much. And so, for example, when you have a comet nucleus, it has a charge sheath around it, but it's not attached to the nucleus. It's above the nucleus. It's not attached to the nucleus, and that's what's drawing in the electron sheath around the nucleus of a comet, is drawing in the positively charged tail material, ions and dust particles, etc. And it's part of an electrical circuit. It's not part of the nucleus itself. The nucleus is just the thing that starts the discharge. And once the discharge starts, all of the rest of it is plasma around the nucleus. It's not attached to the nucleus. So it's a misnomer to say that the comet nucleus is charged. The comet nucleus is not charged. it's inside a charge sheath, which is very different. And so anyway, I started realizing these things, and then also realizing that once you get above the size of, say, a grain of sand, or certainly anything larger than a tennis ball or maybe a golf ball size, the electrical sheathing, the electrical charging on the surface of an object is so small compared to the gravitational force that it has no effect at all. So electrical charging in outer space is only for very small objects. And so this was something that I realized. And there's something else called that I discovered. I had to ask this question dealing with just gravitational fields. Say you have the sun and you have another object out here just dealing with gravitational fields. What is the surface around the smaller object where the sun gravitational field dominates? Where the sun, if you had something put there, the sun would pull it away. Or if what is this artificial surface around the object, the smaller object, that's, you have the sun, for example, and then you have this, maybe the Earth, something much smaller. And the just talking gravitationally, what does this surface look like that within that surface, the Earth would dominate and pull the particle towards it? And now the other thing is then you have to put this into two dimensions and three dimensions and also include rotational dynamics. And it turns out that the surface around the Earth, let's say, as a secondary object, gravitational object, the surface is a circle. In two dimensions, it's a sphere in three dimensions. And so I call it the circle of equal force. And that is where the force of the sun pulling on the object is exactly equal to the force of the Earth. And inside that surface, the Earth dominates. Outside that surface, the sun dominates. And so it's a circle, it turns out. And this is something I proved mathematically. It's also in my three-part comet paper that you'll find at the appendix of the Planet Earth Comets and Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. But it's a mathematical construct, and it's very interesting because as the, say, the Earth, as if you move it closer and closer to the sun, the circle of equal force gets smaller and smaller. And that was very interesting because when you do this with electrical forces, say the sun has an electrical sheath and the Earth has an electrical sheath, both negatively charged, then the if you bring the charge sheath of the Earth or the comet nucleus or whatever it is closer to the sun, the circle of equal force gets smaller and smaller, which means that the head of the comet would get smaller and smaller, and that's an observed phenomenon. So when I'm in the stacks in Cornell reading about cometary information and understanding the historical observations of comets, one of the very common things today, it's also recognized with the green sheaths, and I'll be talking about that later on, is that they become smaller when they approach the sun. So this is a characteristic of charged sheaths. And why wouldn't it be a gravitational sheath? Because the gravitational fields are very weak for very small objects. When we're talking about comet nuclei that are 10 miles across, there's essentially no gravitational field to speak of, certainly nothing that would extend out tens of thousands of miles like you see in the coma around a comet. So we're dealing with electrical objects. And in the very beginning, I even humored the opinion that maybe comet nuclei, even though they were small, were very dense, like the piece of a neutron star, something that dense. And that, of course, eventually it became clear that all of the other phenomenon were related to electrical phenomenon, not mass, not gravitational phenomenon. And then it became very clear. And my second published paper in a peer-reviewed journal dealt with Saturn and the fact that one of the spacecraft that went by Saturn had electrical activity, magnetic electric activity from a small moon. And so anyway, I had predicted these small moons. In fact, the name of the paper was Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted. And it was very clear that these were electrical effects, and I was still at the time in the paper actually talk about these potentially being very massive neutron star, pieces of neutron star. And but eventually, of course, all of the other effects, the electromagnetic effects, bore out to the fact that these were electrical effects. You know, and a spacecraft is a relatively small item in outer space when you're dealing with the non-uniform electric fields that surround these charged objects, the moons that are surrounding Saturn. There were the sweeper moons, etc. Anyway, the whole point was that before I ever got to Cornell, before I ever started seeing the plethora of spacecraft data that I was had available there, I had already worked out all of the mathematics and the theoretical work on understanding what electric fields look like and act like in outer space, because I knew. And I knew that a lot of the people had very big misconceptions. They thought, well, electricity, that's much more powerful than gravity. Therefore, if you had electrical things in outer space, planets would go flying around, etc. And it's totally, totally incorrect, complete misconceptions by people who don't know what they're doing. And so the only real big effects of electrically charged particles in outer space occur for the very smallest objects, like grain of sand and smaller. And so that's in the comet, getting back to the comet issue, and the book by TJJC, it's called The Selective Action of the Resisting Medium. In the case of C, he did not understand that there was no resisting medium. And in the comet model, I realized that the resisting medium came into the comet nucleus as part of the cometary discharge process. Okay, so I'm out of time. I'll be picking up the same topic next week and putting together the discoveries as they were made. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. Also the water filter webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And still a 10% discount there if you use the coupon code JMCC at checkout. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.